Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Arby's we've gotten through the club are from Georgia, and I've had the plethora of problems with those bees.
That was the beginning of an idea that would become a business opportunity for Ellie Sims and her friends at the Indiana University Beekeeping Club. We'll also hear about what happened to those Georgia bees when they moved up north. School nutrition rules require cafeterias to offer healthy meals to students, but not all schools are equipped to make that food in-house. Harvest Public Media has the story. Then, drones make intentional agricultural fires safer for farmers and the environment. And a couple recipes with Daniel Orr. One uses rhubarb, and the other is full of cheese, eggs, and greens. Food Headlines with Mark Chilla to get an update on what happened this week.
The National Academy of Sciences released a report called A Science-Based Look at Genetically Engineered Crops. It's being called the most comprehensive review of GMOs to date. The researchers addressed issues of nutrition, environmental effects, effects on the farm economy, and monopoly control over seeds. Their conclusion? Genetically modified foods are safe to eat. But as NPR's Dan Charles says, the report also struck down some claims about GMOs. Fred Gould, chair of the study, says they found no evidence that genetically engineered crops lead to increased yields for farmers. The report also suggests more hands-on regulation at the federal level of not just GMOs, but also a new technique called gene editing. You can read the report yourself. Find the link at the bottom of the post on eartheats.org. The trend of going gluten-free continues to grow, and the food industry has answered this demand with new replacement ingredients and enthusiastic labeling. But the benefits of cutting out the protein, found most often in wheat and other grains, or used in refined form as a thickener, have been controversial. People who suffer from celiac disease are incapable of digesting gluten, and eating even a little bit can make them very sick. Non-celiac gluten sensitivity, or NCGS, causes similar symptoms in some older adults and can be diagnosed with testing. Now, a doctor tracking the gluten-free trend is warning patients not to put their children on such diets unless they suffer from a diagnosed condition like celiac disease or wheat allergy. Gastroenterologist Narel Rizkul-O'Reilly, director of the Celiac Disease Center's pediatric program at Columbia University, wrote in the Journal of Pediatrics that removing gluten from children's diets could increase other health risks, due in part to higher fat and sugar replacement products. Riley adds that according to a 2015 survey of more than 1,500 American adults, 35% reported no reason as explanation for selecting gluten-free foods. A recent Gallup poll showed that 1 in 5 Americans try to include gluten-free foods in their diet. Bees have been disappearing for over a decade, and two surveys confirm that the trend is continuing. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agriculture Statistics Service surveyed 3,300 beekeeping operations with 5 or more colonies, and 20,000 beekeepers with fewer than 5 colonies. It's the first official honeybee colony loss survey. As of January this year, there were 8% fewer bee colonies than in early 2015. A separate survey released this month from the Bee Informed Partnership at the University of Maryland found American beekeepers lost 44% of their bees from 2015 to 2016. One of the culprits is the varroa mite, a parasite unique to beehives that survives on insect blood. Varroa mites were the top colony stressor for beekeeping operations with 5 or more colonies last year. The mite was reported in 43% of commercial hives between April and June 2015. You can read more on our website and see what other stories pinged our radar this week on Twitter. Find our corner of the internet by searching for Earth Eats.
Cool. Thanks, Mark.
Yep. See you next week.
It's been almost 3 years since the U.S. Department of Agriculture set new nutrition standards for school meals. Almost all schools across the country have complied, cutting salt, fat, and calories, and providing more fruits and vegetables. But many schools still don't have kitchens equipped to make the healthier lunches appealing. Andy Marceau reports from Kansas for Harvest Public Media.
On a Friday morning in the kitchen at Topeka's Eisenhower Middle School, potatoes are about to hit the oven. The mixer at the end of the counter where the dicing is happening looks like it's been in service since the school's namesake was president. Kitchen manager Patricia Adolfson says it's almost that old.
Yeah, that mixer's been here ever since the school's been here, but it works.
At Eisenhower, the lunchroom doubles as a hallway during passing periods, but at least it has its own kitchen. More than half the schools in this Kansas district don't. Their food is prepared at a central kitchen and then trucked in. Nicole Yonke, the director of food services, says it can sit in warming trays for a long time.
The food may start out really yummy and crispy, but after it sits in the hot cart for a couple hours, it's definitely losing its quality.
At Whitson Elementary School, the meal trays come from racks in a tall stainless steel warmer plugged into the wall. Fourth grader Lamaya Taylor thinks school lunch is pretty good.
I like school lunch because, like, if you don't have, like, any food to bring from home to eat for lunch because you have to eat it for dinner or something like that, they provide school lunch and they make sure that you eat a meal every day.
But Taylor says the warmed-over vegetables go from her tray to the trash. That adds to the evidence the nutrition standards have led to more food waste. A University of Vermont study of two elementary schools documented a 56% increase in the amount of fruits and vegetables kids were throwing away in the first year. In Kansas, the number of kids taking school lunch at all has dipped since the standards were introduced, after decades of steady increases. Desmond Smith was less than impressed with some of the meals he got in middle school. Now he's a freshman at Topeka High.
High school, I don't even eat lunch. I just go home.
The sodium-packed food schools used to serve kept better, and some would say tasted better. Yonke says initially, when the Topeka district was transitioning to these nutrition standards, they had to cut out condiments to keep meals under the calorie and sodium limits.
I even had parents calling me, like, "You don't have ketchup on your hamburgers." I was like, "I know, it's just sad."
Ketchup is back on the menu as more fresh ingredients with less sodium have been added. That's required more fridge space, and Eisenhower got a convection oven, which the potatoes are roasting in. The federal government knew schools across the country would need to upgrade their kitchens. In 2009, they made $100 million in stimulus funds available for that. But there was more than $600 million worth of applications. Pew Charitable Trust sent a survey to food service officials the year the new standards went into effect. In Kansas, 72% of those who responded said they still needed more equipment. Nationwide, 88% said they needed more. Whitson Elementary's principal is optimistic that school will soon have the equipment to at least do hot prep. Fourth grader Matthew Ginrich is looking forward to that.
It would always be really warm since they would make it from here, and it wouldn't be shipped from any school.
Under the current guidelines, schools will again be expected to cut their sodium counts next year, this time by as much as 24% for high school lunches. That means schools will need to offer even more fresh fruit and salad bars and hot meals made from scratch. State officials say about half of Kansas schools still need more equipment to do that. Yonke in Topeka has a wish list.
They have machines that you can put your produce in, and then it will put it in a little cup and seal it. Even if we just had one district-wide and then, you know, like, send it out, I would love that.
The U.S. House and Senate are considering competing versions of a bill to reauthorize the nutrition standards. Both include more money for school kitchen upgrades, as well as some low-interest loans. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Andy Marceau.
That story from Harvest Public Media and the KHI News Service in Kansas. Now to the fully equipped Earth Eats kitchen to do some cooking. Eggs and cheese and greens coming up. But first, Chef Daniel Orr says a compote is basically fruit cooked down with sugar. Add whatever seasonings you like, and your compote could work just as well in a dessert as in a first course cheese plate. We'll be using rhubarb today, which is not actually a fruit, it's a vegetable. Unlike some vegetables, you definitely cannot eat the leaves on a rhubarb plant. They're toxic. But waste not, want not. Chef Orr suggests grinding the leaves down and using them as a bug repellent.
Now, I grow rhubarb in my garden, and you can see it right here. It has a long stem, almost like celery, and then a big, big leaf, almost like an elephant's ear. What you normally do is get a nice big crop of rhubarb in the late spring, early summer, and then you let the plant grow back through the late summer and into the fall, and that what that does is it re-nourishes the root system, so then next spring you'll have more rhubarb. So you don't want to cut your rhubarb too late into the season. All right, so we bring the rhubarb into the kitchen. What we're going to do is slice it up, and today we're going to make a rhubarb compote, but you could use it in many of the same ways that you use an apple butter. And rhubarb has kind of a sweet, sour flavor. Okay, to this we're going to add some sugar, and that will start pulling out the moisture in the rhubarb. A little bit of lemon juice in there to get it going, again playing off that sour flavor. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to let this cook down until it almost purees itself. It's almost like celery now, kind of crisp and crunchy, but as it cooks slowly, you can add a little more water if you need to. It will become very, very soft and mushy and then turn into almost like an apple butter consistency. What we have here is a pre-baked tart shell. This is puff pastry. We're going to fill the inside with some of this rhubarb and top it with the strawberries. Now what I've done is I've macerated the strawberries with a little bit of strawberry jam so they're nice and shiny. All right, a couple sprigs of mint, and you've got a perfectly wonderful, easy dessert that just tastes like summer in Indiana.
Also, be sure to check out his rhubarb consommé. And that's with some white wine, orange zest, and mint. And the classic strawberry rhubarb pie, two different takes on that from our bloggers Natalie Ray Good and Stephanie Weaver.
All right, I'm just chopping up some garlic for this next recipe. We're going to do a recipe with cheese curds. What they are is the beginning, like if you're going to make a cheddar cheese, the first thing you do is make the cheese curds, and then you put it into a press, and you've heard of the curds in the whey. So the whey is the liquid that runs off, and the curds are the coagulated proteins from the cheese. All right, we're going to move over to the stove. All right, so this is going to be another breakfast dish that we're going to do today. I'm going to start with some garlic. We want to let it just start to get a little bit brown around the exterior. Now we're going to add some greens. I've got some wilted kale and some arugula. And I'm tossing that with the garlic and the oil. And we're going to add some cherry tomatoes. Okay, I'm going to turn down the heat, crack some eggs. All right, and then we have those cheese curds that we're going to drop over the top. Okay, and then I'm going to put this in a preheated 400-degree oven, sprinkle it again with a little bit more salt and pepper over the eggs, and we're going to bake them until the whites are set, but the yolks are still a bit runny. Okay, and that will be in a preheated oven. That will be about 8 minutes.
The finished product is gooey and colorful and sort of looks like a crustless pizza. Swap out the kale and arugula for collards and spinach if you like. Instead of cheese curds, consider using paneer. The recipe can be your starting point. It's on eartheats.org in the new podcast post. Coming up, a young beekeeper says maybe the weather is to blame for the death of his hive.
A harsher winter, that really hurts bees. I mean, it takes them a really long time to adjust, especially if they're not used to it ever before.
Lucas Maley talks about the benefits of keeping bees acclimated to a single area of the country. production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats. Hello, I'm Annie Corrigan. Every spring, farmers and ranchers intentionally burn their fields to jumpstart the natural process of renewal. But those fires can be dangerous. That's why researchers in Nebraska are designing a new drone. As Ariana Brocious reports for Harvest Public Media, it starts fires and it may help protect people and the environment.
On a warm spring morning, a big burn crew dressed in yellow and green flame-resistant clothing gets ready to set 26 acres of tall grass prairie on fire.
Okay, yep, and once he kind of does that, we get to take a...
Mark Engler, the park superintendent at Homestead National Monument near Beatrice in southeastern Nebraska, says today's prescribed burn is special. A team from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln is trying out a new tool, a fire-starting drone.
Introducing this technology is an important step forward for us in testing new methods to work not only prescribed fires, but really wildland fires.
The burn team starts lighting the edge of the prairie with drip torches, basically big gas cans with a wick. As firefighters walk along the growing flames, UNL computer science professor Sebastian Elbaum gets the drone ready to launch.
Are you getting excited?
Yes, I am.
So what are we about to see?
So I think once they build this horseshoe shape of black area, then we're going to have our drones there fly across this field and drop some of these balls that will ignite into a flame and hopefully help them perform the task that those guys right at the center are performing right now, which can get risky if the wind changes or if they get caught up in there.
Once the drone is airborne, it drops ping pong balls filled with a flammable fluid into the unburned area in the middle of the field. In less than a minute, the chemical reaction inside sets the balls on fire. UNL's Nimbus Lab adapted this firefighting technology, already used with helicopters, to work on a drone. Agronomy and horticulture professor Derek Twidwell studies fire ecology and is part of the fire drone team.
Fire's been historically so important to keeping our prairies healthy and managing for the biological diversity that's endemic to Nebraska and elsewhere in the Great Plains.
Fire reduces plant litter, helps seeds germinate, and keeps invasive plants and trees, like eastern red cedar, out of grasslands. Twidwell says fire plays a big role in agricultural productivity of the plains.
Our grassland species are becoming increasingly more rare and threatened. We're starting to see more endangered species pop up. We have an 80% loss of livestock productivity on our native rangelands when we see, you know, things like cedar overtake them.
Getting rid of cedar trees is why farmer and rancher Mark Alberts started burning his land 15 years ago. He's burn boss for the Central Platte Rangeland Alliance, a collection of landowners that help each other burn fields and pastures in central Nebraska. His group does big prescribed burns, 800 acres on average, often in cedar-filled canyon country.
It's rough. It's very rough terrain, very rugged.
Albert says he'd definitely be interested in using a drone in those rugged areas normally set aflame by guys carrying drip torches on foot or riding ATVs.
The drones enable to drop fire in those inaccessible areas. It's much safer.
Other farmers that burn small, flat fields say they may not need the technology. But Alberts says he's interested in using the drone as a camera, too.
Because sometimes our burn will be 2 square miles, and the terrain is so rugged you just can't see from one end to the other. So if you had eyes in the sky, that'd be great.
Well, I think it has a lot of potential. It stands to improve the safety of prescribed fire.
Casey McCoy, acting fire program leader for the Nebraska Forest Service, says that improved safety
could save lives.
We've had a fairly challenging track record here in Nebraska. In the last several years, 5 to 6 years, we've had a number of fatalities associated with prescribed fires.
Burn bosses say the drone won't remove the need for human firefighters, and they'd invest in other essential equipment, like water tenders, before a drone. Still, technology to keep humans out of harm's way may become part of a firefighter's or rancher's toolkit in the future. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Ariana Brocious.
A one-stop shop for ag stories from all over the country. HarvestPublicMedia.org. We heard earlier today about two new surveys that both found that bee populations continue to struggle. There could be a number of reasons why, from pests to pesticides to something the USDA is calling unknown colony health stressors. We start this story with a visit to a struggling hive.
Do you want to wear one of these? Or?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Ellie Sims has just handed me a beekeeping hat and mask. I struggle to fit it over top of my headphones, and then I have to wrap the string around my recording equipment and around my waist to secure the net.
This, I think, is inherently not comfortable.
Yeah. I am so used to it now.
But you have shorts on, so you're not worried about your legs or your feet?
No. And you're technically not supposed to wear red, but my Chiefs won last night, so.
I'm with her at the hives she helps manage at Indiana University's Hilltop Garden and Nature Center. Sims is the president of Indiana University's Beekeeping Club, but she doesn't consider herself an expert. She's only been working with bees for 3 years. In that time, though, she has experienced plenty of ups and downs.
I don't get intimidated about the bees anymore. Once you understand their behaviors, it's just like, oh, well, he's doing that now. I'll do a little bit more smoke. And I've been stung, and being stung is really not so bad. It's really not. So, like, one time, I accidentally, you know, almost smushed a bee on the edge of a frame, and she panicked and stung me. And then another time, I thought it was okay to not use smoke. I cracked, I think it was this hive last year open, and it just, like, shot out right away and got me in the leg. And that was my first sting. I actually was, like, really excited. Like, probably the only person to get excited by a sting. I was like, I'm a real beekeeper now. Like, yes. The wind just picked up. When I first got here, this was no problem. There we go. All right. This is the hardest part about beekeeping is the smoker, to be honest. So this hive's kind of struggling. They're not going to make it through winter because they don't have, number one, they don't have enough numbers. And number two, the honey stores are super weak.
Gosh, so you're just planning on total failure for this hive.
Yeah.
That is so sad. Are you devastated?
Beekeeping is a soap opera, I've learned. And honestly, I used to get really upset and get really emotional about it, but now it's just like, okay. Oh, I just smushed one. Oh, God, that's sad. And now he's going. See him wiggling the tail? The other guy? Yeah. Okay, that was sad. All right, I'm sorry.
That conversation was from last fall. Sure enough, that hive did not make it through the winter. It wasn't unexpected, but it did hit Ellie hard. What she would soon realize is that failure would lead to new opportunity. This spring, she was invited to make a presentation to the Indiana University Foundation about the student beekeeping club that she was in charge of.
I was at this point where personally I was feeling like a lull in my interest and in the club. I felt like I, you know, there's not much farther I can go here. And when this happened, I remember being so excited. So I came back to the boys and told them, like, they believe in us. Like, they think we have all this potential. And we had a meeting, a call with them 2 weeks later, and we already had an idea. Like, we already had something, like, ready to go.
Yeah. As soon as Ellie presented that to us, I think a light bulb kind of went off.
That's Lucas Maley. They were told to think about opportunities beyond the beekeeping club.
We just started spitballing ideas all over the place. Mm-hmm. We were like, okay, technology. Technology hive, never been done before. There's opportunity there. Yep. Okay, what are we going to do? How can we benefit the bees? How can we just disrupt the industry? What's the industry like? Oh my gosh, so much like research to do.
What they learned is that honeybees are shipped all over the country, to beekeepers wanting a hive of their own and to farmers who rent bee colonies to pollinate their crops. As the population of honeybees continues to decrease, the prices farmers and beekeepers are paying are going up. And then they remembered their failed beehive. The club purchased those bees from Georgia. Maley hypothesized that the relocation 680 miles north to Indiana's harsh winter climate surely stressed out the bees.
That really hurts bees. I mean, it takes them a really long time to adjust, especially if they're not used to it ever before. It's yeah. basically like somebody who's never experienced snow before. It's like, what is this?
But you also have to think of, I mean, so the diseases that are in the environment, the pests they're interacting with are going to be different from place to place. The crops are different from place to place. So the things that they're interacting in the environment are also affecting them as well. So it's not just climate. It's also what is around them.
Throughout their research, they came up with more questions than they found answers. What if they could incorporate technology into their hives to monitor things like temperature and pesticide levels and pollen count to try to figure out what's causing bee deaths? And what if bees in this area only worked for farmers in this area so the pollinators could stay in the climate they're accustomed to? Those two ideas are the cornerstones of their young business, the Bee Corp. Maley, Sims, and fellow co-founder Simon Kuntz received a $100,000 investment for winning this year's Building Entrepreneurs in Software and Technology competition through Indiana University's School of Informatics and Computing and the Kelley School of Business. They want to start the business with 500 hives, and they know not all of those colonies will survive the first season.
I mean, we're expecting that to happen. Like that.
We're preparing for the worst.
Yeah, I mean, that's beekeeping. So having hives to die over the winter will not be fatal. It hasn't even been fatal for the club, you know, to not have bees. But it will tell us that something we're doing is wrong, and it will help us change and be better.
They want to make the data they collect available to the public so researchers can continue to understand why we're losing so many bees. Ellie Sims and Lucas Maley are two-thirds of the Bee Corp. More interviews, more recipes, and more news at eartheats.org. The team at Earth Eats includes Aya Bonbinder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Our executive producer is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Find us on iTunes so you can listen on your own schedule. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Annie Corrigan.